Good morning. The Commerce Committee is called to order for Wednesday, January 26th. And good morning, members. And this committee is a little unique in that we actually have committee hearings 2 days in a row. We don't have that normal gap in between. So it's rapid fire this week on insurance overviews. Yesterday, I think everybody that's here right now was here for at least part of or most of the presentation yesterday. We took a glimpse, a high-altitude view of the property and casualty insurance market and also the life insurance market. And one of the I'll just say that if you're not real familiar with the whole insurance industry, a lot of these industries that we're dealing with in the Commerce Committee, you'll find that there is the for-profit angle, and there's also different angles, for example, with yesterday with the life. We had life insurance companies, and we also had fraternals. We had the property and casualty companies, and then we also had the mutual, which were the membership-driven ones. We'll have the same thing with the banks, and we have credit unions. A lot of these industries are going to have those sort of counterbalancing options in the marketplace. So today we're going to shift from the property and casualty side of insurance over to the healthcare, and this is a completely—it's a very different marketplace in healthcare than it is in property, casualty, or life insurance. And you could argue certainly there isn't a lot of the competitive elements that there are in those other industries, and that has some effects and some impacts on the marketplace. But we're going to start off with some gentlemen, Mr. John Tyler and Mr. Greg Saylor from the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, who are going to give us a high-altitude view of how do underwriters fit into the health insurance world, what do they do, and what the relationship between our committee and the legislation that the state does and the oversight with their industry. So with that, members, let's go ahead and begin with the overview. So I don't know who's going to start first. Mr. Tyler? So, Mr. Tyler, which if you would, for the record, introduce yourself and your proper title and for the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for the privilege of being here to address you on some of these important issues. The primary reason is to give you basically a foundation of an understanding of how insurance works for the purpose of some bills that will be coming up. My name is John Tyler. I'm a principal owner of Boies and Tyler Financial Group. We're an insurance agency that has been in business since 1981. We work in the employee benefits area, small, mid, and large group sizes, individual marketplace. We have about 300 business groups and about 2,000 individuals. We also work in the area of individual life insurance, disability insurance, health insurance, and so forth, retirement plans, et cetera. I also am very actively involved on the legislative committee of our professional organization, one of four, called the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. So my position there is the offensive strategy chair as far as putting together ideas and things for real reform issues. I'd like to spend a few minutes with you this morning just to kind of explain a little bit about who we are as a profession. And each of you should have a handout that looks like this. It talks about the agent's world. The association or the health underwriters is also somewhat synonymous with the word agent or the word broker as well. But what we are involved with is actually servicing both the individual marketplace as well as the business environment as well, the small business owners, mid or even large business owners as well. And we are actually, our profession is actually directly involved in the insurance or insuring over 2.4 million Minnesotans. And so we are actually the advisors, consultants, educators, if you will, financial analysts as well, that work in a variety of areas. So our particular agency works we have actually a number of feet in a number of different areas. Some agents specialize in one, others actually are generalists, and our agency are generalists. Our primary purpose really is to insure the uninsured. You know, that's really what we do. That's kind of what we are attempting to do. So our role is actually, as far as our business clients are concerned, is to help them weave through the really very complex puzzle that is rules and regulations, both state and federal. So sometimes our clients basically say our job is to keep them out of jail. You know, to make sure everything is compliant with all the rules and regulations, et cetera. We also are licensed in Minnesota and appointed through quite a number of different insurance companies. And we have an obligation to the insurance companies as well to properly present their products and services to the marketplace as a whole. So we actually are held accountable by the Department of Commerce for all of those things. And so basically our real boss is actually the Commerce Commissioner. And so we all adhere to, you know, to that. But basically, we also work with the general public as far as insuring individuals, to the degree that we work with HRAs or health reimbursement arrangements or HSAs, health savings account plans. We're involved with some of the healthcare and banking as well. I would have to say that that the world of health insurance in particular is probably as poorly understood an industry as exists, quite frankly. And one of the second handout here is the myths and misconceptions that you should have available to you as well. I'm just going to touch on a few things with this. I'd like to direct your attention to this. There are a lot of rumors, a lot of hearsay, a lot of things that float around as fact that really aren't, quite frankly. And so that's why we put this little piece together, just to kind of illustrate or illuminate some of those things. One of the issues there is often comes under criticism is health insurance administration costs being somewhere between 30-40% or something ridiculous out there, and how much more efficient other types of perhaps government plans are. As Catherine Commit from the Minnesota Health Plan Council of Health Plans will be talking about in a minute, the annual filings of the state of Minnesota indicate about a 7.9% administration cost. The rest goes to claims, as far as the local insurers. The Medicare, Medicaid services, et cetera, really don't even have a track record quite that good. So if you're looking for efficiency, the private insurance administration market is actually there. One myth is that
Medicare. Mr. Tyler?
Yes, sir.
If I could ask a question, and I should say the format we've been is that if folks have questions, jump on in. I'll recognize them, and so we can catch them at the point of interest. Something that's helpful to us is to know where does Minnesota stand in relation to other states. So the data point of 7.9% for administrative costs, how does that compare with other states around the country?
Actually, I think we're very low in that particular area. I think we're very competitive. Ninth lowest is my understanding, and I think Catherine Commit will be talking about that issue. I think I stole that from her presentation here, but I think she'll be talking about that, you know, here in a few minutes.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any other questions? Thus far. Okay. The third one down is or the second one down is the Medicare administration costs are so very efficient, but in the calculations that are provided, 3-6%. It does not include the cost of actually collecting the premiums and other administrative duties that are common in the private marketplace overall. If you look at Milliman and Company's actuarial firm, they'll tell you that their actual administration costs for MA and Medicare is closer to 17-18%, including all costs and services. The third one down is insurance companies have regularly rescinded health insurance coverage when individuals fall ill. The new federal health care law has corrected this, has come to the rescue by making rescissions actually illegal. The fact of the matter is that guaranteed renewability has been a Minnesota statute and a statute in virtually every state that I'm aware of, forever. It's already illegal to rescind coverage for any other reason than misrepresentation or fraud. So Minnesota has already had that in statute, you know, for many years. So if any insurance company really attempted that, they'd be escorted to the border by our Commerce Commissioner and basically said don't come back, because they'd be actually literally by law actually exited out of the state and prohibited from doing business here. It is unfair to deny, fourth one down, it's unfair to deny or rate coverage based on pre-existing medical conditions. The underwriting process is one that actually needs to be understood and appreciated. And if you think about a life insurance policy or a disability insurance policy or a long-term care policy or any of those types of things that you would apply underwriting to, that particular process is well understood as a means of keeping premiums low and benefits high and maintaining the solvency of the various carriers. If you apply underwriting to the health insurance marketplace, suddenly the same criteria for the same reason suddenly is unfair and discriminatory. It is basically the process by which insurance companies maintain solvency. They evaluate risk before they take the risk on and assign premiums accordingly. And so the pre-existing condition, by the way, is a HIPAA, federally imposed requirement on insurance policies. So the pre-existing condition limitations that you have oftentimes criticized are actually government imposed. It's not an insurance company imposed. So but they are there to help protect the solvency of the insurance industry and the ability for the carriers to pay the claims of its enrollees. Basically, and also there as a motivation to motivate people to maintain continuous coverage, so that the jumpers and dumpers, the people that jump between carriers or just want to feel like they want to insure the house after it's burning, can't get away with that. Because if they do that, that will actually wreck the insurance industry, you know, from a solvency perspective. Minnesota residents, the last one on the first page, Minnesota residents with pre-existing conditions cannot purchase individual health insurance coverage. And I think the you can look to your own body, the Minnesota Legislature back from 1976, that passed the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association Act that creates a risk pool that if anyone is declined for standard health insurance coverage, they are guaranteed a free pass into the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association that collects a 2.7% premium surcharge in all fully insured plans to maintain their solvency.
Senator Brown has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question on the Minnesota Comp. If someone loses their job and they have the option of COBRA but they can't afford COBRA, can they still get into Minnesota Comp?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, yes, absolutely. And one of the criteria for applying to the MCHA is the ability to afford. And so if they don't need to run that COBRA situation out to then be eligible for the MCHA. A very simple letter of saying my COBRA premiums would be X, I cannot afford X, I have a pre-existing condition, whatever that is, and the MCHA will allow them into the MCHA risk pool.
Thank you.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, when we have the federal health care bill in effect and there's no longer pre-existing condition exclusion, what will happen to MSHA? Will its need be eradicated? What do you think?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, yes.
And Mr. Chair, have you a plan for that? Have you done any thinking about what that might look like?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, can you be a little more clear on what your question is? I don't quite know.
Would you just discontinue? Would you send these people notices? I mean, what's...
Oh, I see.
Oh,
sure.
Right.
You want to take that?
Let me just say, too, also, Senator Bonoff, we will have a presentation from MCHA coming up today, here yet. And so...
Ask them.
Yeah, okay. If you wanted to take a stab at that's fine, but we will have an MCHA presentation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, I'll take a stab at it. I think it would be very, very unfortunate if the MCHA were to sunset. It provides an extremely valuable service. One of the most important aspects about it, in my view, is that it has very affordable premiums for the quality of the plans that are being purchased. It's a very strong contract. I think no one has to apologize for it. It's probably the strongest individual plan that actually exists, at least in my view. So you're not asking someone to take a step down as far as access to providers, not asking that as far as what the coverage costs or covers. Mental health, chemical dependency. It has a 6-month pre-ex that can be waived if you had prior continuous coverage, et cetera. Even if you're coming off of a publicly insured plan, the pre-ex can be waived because of prior continuous coverage, et cetera. So it really is very valuable. So it would sunset under the current federal legislation. Basically, say people could go and buy an individual plan, a standard issue plan. But the key question is, what would those cost? And we do have some precedent there in states of New York and Massachusetts and others that have issued programs like that. And affordability is no longer in the equation of those types of plans for people, regretfully. So that's my stab. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going to the top of the second page, Minnesota's uninsured population cannot afford health insurance. Well, I think if you look at our population of roughly 9%, that the 60% are already eligible for publicly insured plans and choose not to enroll. Single payer eliminates high administration costs. I think if you look at the administration costs of proposed single payer bills, that is really not a true statement at all. Any of the publicly insured plans right now have got comparatively high expenses and very high aggregate costs as compared to the private sector. Higher healthcare spending increases in 2010 are due to higher patient utilization. Individuals are using more healthcare services, and Catherine Commit in a follow-up presentation will be addressing that in more detail. That truly isn't the case. It's really due to an increase in costs of per unit of care, but the cost shifting issue is really cost shifting between underpayment for public plans to the private sector is one of the main drivers of why there's cost push pressure onto ever escalating costs of per unit care. So cost shifting, Milliman estimates that a major portion of the pressure to increase private sector reimbursement rates is because of the underpayments that are going to providers for Minnesota Care, medical assistance, and Medicare as well. So we have roughly a third of our population enroll in public plans, and it's increasing. And we have a decreasing population in the that are actually insured in the private sector, putting more and more pressure on the cost per unit. So that's one of the main issues. So we'll be talking in future bills, we'll be talking about how to address the cost shifting issue. If we're really going to get to trend and utilization issues, we need to get to the issue of cost shifting and how do we do that.
Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you think the legislative solution on the general assistance medical care program last year helped or worsened that situation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Reinert, in my opinion, I think it helped it. I think it was, but I think the jury is still out on that. I think it needs to sort of run its course, to find out. But I think it actually has a lot of positive elements to it. One of the most important being affordability, and I think the early enrollment of MA takes those people, puts them back into a more of a capitated model that's much more expensive, for the state. I don't think is an improvement because in my opinion. It jeopardizes the solvency of the entire medical assistance program. Adding up to 163,000 people to the rolls on an average cost of over $400 a month per head is going to add increased cost, to the rolls back into traditional medical assistance. So I think there were some positive elements to it, and I would love to see basically it run its course.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, Mr. Charlie.
Okay. I think at this point, I'll just defer to my colleague, Greg Seiler, and he'll go through the balance of the presentation that you see before you.
Senator Gerlach, other senators, thank you for having us this morning. My name is Greg Seiler. I am the president of Seiler Benefit Services. We are an employee benefits consulting firm in Lake Elmo and Woodbury, Minnesota. I also come to you as the past president of the Health Underwriters Association and currently chairman of the board of the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters. And my job for you today is to present to you the overview of private health care coverage. John's done a very good job on his portion. Hopefully I can do the same thing here. I'm going to pop through these things real quick that way. The Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, if you don't know who we are MAHU is our acronym. We are Minnesota brokers and agents representing 2.4 million individuals in the state of Minnesota and influence more than 80% of the employers in this state. MAHU's members are licensed experts in health care benefits who provide insurance products for the majority of Minnesotans through privately owned and employer-sponsored group insurance. Brokers, agents, consultants, insurance companies, and benefit administrators who specialize in individual and group medical, dental, disability, life insurance, and long-term care, a whole bunch of things there. But that's what we specialize in, and that's what we do. We also represent the Agents Coalition for Healthcare Reform. These are 58,000 licensed health insurance agents in Minnesota, which includes the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, NAIPA, Minnesota, Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers, professional insurance agents. And our mission of the coalition is to present a united voice for professional health insurance agents and their clients concerning legislative health care and insurance reform issues. How does the market work? We've got a couple pieces that come into play here. Healthcare consumers and healthcare providers. Nothing else would be needed if the price of healthcare services were more affordable. Life-saving healthcare services are too expensive for most people, so health insurance allows people to pool their money to pay for the unexpected and expected medical costs that they're going to be receiving. Insurance companies, part of the equation, pool the money to pay for medical claims. They are obligated to protect enrolled individuals from unexpected large health care claims. The first purpose is financial protection of their pool of insureds. Individuals transfer financial risk from themselves to the insurance company to pay for these high claims or any claims that they have. Insurance premiums are the price you pay for insurance coverage. Total premiums must pay all medical claims plus the cost of managing the insurance company. And in our presentation just a minute ago, we shared with you that our administrative costs are 7.9%, a very low for national average. Medical claims spending is the chief driver of insurance premiums. 92.7% of each premium dollar is spent on medical claims. In 2010, increases in healthcare spending were due to increased unit cost, not to patient utilization. And this is from Milliman & Company, a national actuarial service that does a lot of things in this area. Stability of health insurance premiums allows for the continuation of adequate income from which to pay the premiums. The process of risk management is called underwriting, as John mentioned. Underwriting balances new risk entering the pool against the obligation to pay future claims for existing insured individuals. So what does the market look like? The employer group insurance market, which we have divided into a couple different areas, is small employers, which are 2 to 50 employees. We have large employers, which are 51-plus employees. And then the large employers are either fully insured or self-funded. The small group pool, each insurance company that we work with in Minnesota has one pool for all employers with 2 to 50 employees. The policies are guaranteed issue, so everyone gets a policy, and we use the HIPAA pre-existing condition protection clause for the risk pool and responsible individuals. Employers have price predictability with protection on allowable rate increases. And almost all small groups are fully insured. The risk is transferred to the insurance company for these size companies. Large employers, which are 50-plus employees, up to 1,000 or larger, are either fully insured or self-funded. 1,000-plus employers generally are self-funded, where they cover their own risk up to a certain safety net and purchase stop-loss coverage to cover those higher risks.
Could I interrupt you for a moment for a question? Just for the benefit of the committee, we deal a lot with the difference of the fully insured or self-insured and the impacts that mandates may have and how ERISA plans or those are exempted and such. Could you take a moment and explain exactly what is the difference between fully insured and self-insured? Why would a business choose one route over the other? What influences that? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair, fully insured plans are subject to all of the state mandates that are levied upon them, as well as the taxes and assessments that are placed upon those. Self-funded plans are a little bit different model, and they fall under the federal rules of ERISA. They are not subject to the state plans or the state taxes and all of the mandates. So it makes a big difference there. When you look at the MCHA funding, and I'll be getting that to you here in another slide, 25% of the groups in Minnesota, or 25% of the fully insured people in Minnesota, are actually picking up the cost of the MCHA assessment. You know, and that is a plan that's accessible to not only those coming off of fully insured plans, but those also coming off of self-funded plans, even though their companies and those plans have not picked up any of those costs.
So generally, then, small businesses tend to have to be fully insured because they don't have the assets to bear any of the risk. So they go out to the marketplace and buy insurance and transfer the total risk. As companies are larger, so generally in the marketplace, a larger company with assets that could withstand claims, they find it more in their financial interest, are you saying, to set up a self-insured plan and go into the federal guidelines of ERISA and do that, then that takes them out of the state mandates and a lot of the state requirements and such. So is that, am I correct in that assessment?
Mr. Chair, you are correct.
Okay. All right. Somebody else had a question. Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on that point, could you also, and I know this isn't exactly in the purview of the agent world, but, you know, many who self-insure still go sort of out into the pseudo market for plan administration. And I don't know if you feel comfortable just addressing, you know, for folks at home why that might be.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Reiner, a lot of self-funded groups, there's administration in paying claims and making sure people are covered, enrolled, and so forth, and then the coordination between the reinsurance companies. Many large companies will often do this in-house because they have the staff and the resources to do that. But many companies will also, to keep arm's length and to add other protections, we'll use a TPA service, a third-party administrator, that will help handle all of those pieces, especially when it comes to marketing and things like that, collection of the premiums. Okay. All right, where was that? 1,000-plus employee providers are usually self-funded. Self-insured employers cover their own risk and purchase stop-loss coverage to cover for the large risks. A shift from fully insured to self-funding is going on right now. Because of this, the self-funding groups do not pay the 5.3% in taxes and assessment paid by fully insured groups. When you look at a certain size group, you know, that 5.33% can add up to quite a bit. In fact, I was just working on a group the other day that had 140 employees, and we looked at the taxes and assessments that they were paying. We were getting close to $60,000 in taxes and assessments, not to mention the extra cost that some of the mandates would bring onto the plan for coverage that they would have to cover.
Senator Bonoff?
Mr. Chair, and does that include the provider tax, the 2.whatever, so that's half that?
Yes, it does.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, if I could just interject. The state of Minnesota, the CGIP program, is a self-insured plan, for example.
Yep.
They utilize the services of Health Partners, Medica, and Blue Cross and Blue Shield, you know, to offer those services, and they do so for the exact same reasons.
Okay. All right. Government and private insurance both use underwriting, a little bit different styles. Government underwriting, which they use an eligibility underwriting to protect the government's budget. They look at income, assets, financial status, age, gender, marital status, and employment status. Private insurance coverage to protect the pool uses health status and pre-existing conditions to calculate the future cost to the insurance pool. Let's use an underwriting example. John, Minnesotan, an uninsured individual, has no health care expenses but falls ill. He realizes now and has been told he needs $1,000 a month lifetime medical care. The premium to join the individual pool is $400 per month. Underwriting must protect the current pool, so Health Partners, Medica, whatever, when they do their underwriting, they're going to say no to John. So what has happened to John? All other enrollees have gone through the same underwriting process and have been treated equally. We're not just picking on John. So what happens to John? John is now eligible to join another pool designed for his situation called a high-risk pool. And since 1976, Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, MCHA, has been working very well in Minnesota. John's monthly medical cost is $1,000. His premium for MCHA is $500. So there is a deficit to MCHA of $500. MCHA collects the $500 per month from an assessment, which is 2.5% of premiums paid by fully insured groups. John has guaranteed issue through MCHA, so he will get the plan that he needs. MCHA makes it possible for guaranteed health insurance for unhealthy, high-risk individuals. The 2.5% is for the 2010 numbers, adjusted each year based on the volume of claims versus premiums collected. The assessment is paid only by fully insured Minnesotans again, and 26% of Minnesotans fully insured pay 100% of this assessment. If all Minnesotans were assessed equally, the 2.5% would be dramatically reduced. Or more people could qualify for high-risk plans and reduce premiums for other risk pools. Summary of the risk pools.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Seiler, did I understand you to say earlier that the state of Minnesota insurance plan doesn't pay this 2.5%, but yet we're telling other people they have to, the fully insured individuals that they have to. And you also mentioned that more people are moving to the self-insured. So is that going, in your opinion, is that going to raise that 2.5% to a higher rate because the number's shrinking of who wants to pay that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, what was the first question?
the state of Minnesota,
yes,
not paying.
Yes, you're correct. The state of Minnesota does not pay the 2.5% MCHA assessment.
Why is that? Because we're self-insured.
The state plans are exempt.
But yet we're the one who came up with the rule. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right.
Yeah, it's a little unfair.
Can I just make a comment?
Sure.
Yes. As part of some analysis that I was involved in, Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, excuse me, we looked at that. You know, we actually have the CGIP plan is roughly a half a billion dollar a year plan, And if you take, you know, the premium surcharges and so forth, running roughly in total about 5.3% of that, that's obviously a pretty big figure. So, I mean, the state of Minnesota obviously is trying to do the best it can. You know, so it's really caught between kind of a rock and a hard place. Do we support our own plans and pay much more, or do we, you know, have a self-insured plan?
But didn't you just say that it would lower the cost if more people participated? If the self-insured participated.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, it would lower the cost on average to everybody if we had a different basis other than health insurance premiums.
Okay.
If it was maybe a more universal thing, such as maybe of claims or something to that effect, that all self-insured individuals are participating in, so it won't matter what kind of insurance they have, if they are utilizing claims, it would be spread across a much larger a population and reduce the average cost. So absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Let me just interject something, Senator Brown, too, is the whole issue of the MCHA assessment and the healthcare access fund and all of those things, it's very complicated. There's a many, many layers of public policy decisions and judgment calls that are made. But this is great because the purpose of this hearing here is to expose those types of things. So that's something that all of us would be well served by digging into and learning more about, and so I appreciate the questions, but it's complicated and as far as all of those money transfers. But thanks for raising the issue. Okay, if you want to continue with the presentation,
absolutely. Individual private insurance coverage and employer group coverage. I'm gonna pop to this. Individual private insurance coverage has these two pieces to it: the individual risk pools and high risk pool MCHA. The individual risk pools have the lowest premium because of underwriting. High risk pool has the highest premiums. When employers look at group insurance, we have the fully insured risk pools with low to high premiums, and then self-funded have a low to high premiums. So, you know, when we work with employers to help answer that question, you know, we're looking any increases too much. You know, we're always trying to maintain the status quo for price. So when we work with employers, we are, you know, trying to provide all the options when we look through these things. Health insurance agents are predominantly independent contractors. We're not employed by the carriers. Our job description is to insure the uninsured and to keep people insured continuously. Do health insurance financial analysis for the individuals, what they can afford, what this plan is going to pick up. Becoming insured. Currently, there are two methods to become insured in the private market. Some buy insurance. They know they have an immediate need. Some are sold insurance. That is a voluntary decision. Individuals who buy insurance. These are the individuals who call a health insurance company or agent on their own. We are not in any way incentivizing them to call. They're doing it on their own. They understand that they have a need for insurance immediately. They expect to have medical claims in the very near future. They're hoping their premium will be less than their claims. Often, they are high-risk individuals. Individuals are sold health insurance. These individuals usually do not call agents or insurance companies like unhealthy individuals do. They have no immediate medical need. They believe their premium will be more than their claims, and agents seek them out. That's our job, is to insure the uninsured. Agents' role in the market. We must attract those healthy people to the pool to keep the dollars low, the premiums low. We must keep them insured over the long term, even in the years when they don't have any claims, and they might not see a need for their policy at that time. The companies compensate agents only when the agent sells the coverage and keeps it in force. Okay? The agent is compensated for as long as the person stays insured. We protect the risk pool. Without agents selling to healthy individuals, the insurance company will suffer something called adverse selection. An adverse selection is when you have more unhealthy people in a pool than you actually have healthy people bringing premium dollars in. Adverse selection creates higher insurance premiums, which eliminates healthy people from joining the risk pool. Eventually, only individuals with high claims will still be enrolled in the risk pool, and this is a phenomenon called a death spiral. Adverse selection is a cancer that will kill any insurance company. Challenges and solutions to reform. Application of these market-based principles to publicly insured populations can significantly reduce cost. Improve reimbursements to health care providers, eliminate cost shifting from public to private patients, and help generate positive economic activity. Here's our contact. That's the end of my presentation. Are there any questions?
Any questions from members? Oh, yes, Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm still trying to formulate the question, but if you could click back to the death spiral, the adverse impact slide, the adverse selection slide. It just seems to me anecdotally, there was a significant period of time where I was self-employed and didn't have any coverage. And I was willing to take that risk. I was young, didn't have any outstanding health issues, and knew, but for a car crash, I would be okay. What brought me back into health insurance was the advent of sort of the single policy that was meant for the people that were opting out of the insurance pool. And I'm just wondering if you can maybe reflect on that trend line, and if you felt it had sort of bottomed and that was an important tool to combat adverse selection. I mean, I just know anecdotally that people in their 20s and 30s were opting to go without health insurance, sort of take the risk, but those were exactly the people we would want in the pool to broaden that cost basis.
Senator Reinert, great question. We've got a lot of people that don't have any health issues. They do understand they have a need for health insurance. They look at their family history. They look at that going forward, and they make a judgment call. So we get calls for people on individual policies quite a bit, like in the situation that you were in. And they will say, the word that gets used the most is a catastrophic policy. A lot of people want something they call catastrophic, nothing that's going to pick up the prescriptions or an office visits or something like that. This is what they're asking for is, okay, I don't want to lose everything because of an appendectomy or something like that. So that we often sell them a policy of either whatever their definition of catastrophic is, maybe $2,500, $5,000, or on up. And the market has done a really good job in creating different kinds of policies for different kinds of people. And everyone has different needs and premium dollars that they can spend. So we've got a lot of different things like that. And, yes, by that market creating these alternatives for us, we've been able to help the pools and keep, our uninsured in Minnesota to one of the lowest in the country.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Reinert.
Thank you. Did you see much differentiation in market participation when the products like Simply Blue started coming out that included the preventative as well as the catastrophic, and sort of, donut hole has a whole different connotation, but did create more of that bridge product that's what anecdotally I saw was people started saying, oh, well, this makes sense. Now I have some incentive to do the preventative care things. I get coverage on the basic needs, which aren't much. And I know that if I get in the car wreck that I'm going to have some help on the back end of that. Did you see much versus just the catastrophic policy?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Reinert, yes. The answer is yes. When the plans have kind of moved from, all the plans have done a great job of, we not only have those high deductible plans or mid deductible plans, but they've also created plans with copays again and prescription drug coverage, and they put all these pieces together. I can't tell you exactly how many plans there are off the top of my head. There's over 100 different options, wouldn't you say, John? So, yes, absolutely. All those things are bringing those people back to the market and making sure they're insured.
Okay. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. to me, in all of economics, two terms that are often confused are price and cost. Mm-hmm. And I think nowhere do we see that abused more than in the analysis of insurance. Because the fact of the matter is, if you tell me the price of my insurance policy to you via government fiat is going to be $600 a month, that really has nothing to do with the long-term actuarial cost of that delivery. And so my question, you talk here about improvement of the reimbursement to healthcare providers. Isn't that one of the big problems right now, is that the reimbursements are being set primarily by government outside of the private markets, and the federal government in particular, because of Medicare, Medicaid? How do we as state legislators help you out with prices that are set by your cost structure and a normal rate of return and those kinds of things, as long as the federal government is basically price fixing through the Medicare system? How do we, is there anything we can do other than say, bummer, to use a technical term? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, you know, it is a bummer, and there's a couple of issues at play here. I'd like to just make comment on from the previous question. Getting to the young immortals is a challenge. Those that honestly believe in their hearts that they will never ever have a claim, no matter if they're rock climbing or bungee jumping, it doesn't matter. They're just never going to have a claim. Okay, but the state mandate issue requirements does drive up the cost of health insurance, and one of the things that has happened with the Medi-Solo and the Simply Blue contracts is they have actually allowed individuals to kind of build to a degree a la carte some of their benefits. They've excluded maternity, for example, and they can choose a richer prescription drug benefit if they want or a lesser one, helping to drive that. The maternity is worth 15% alone to premium, that one mandate that is actually excluded from those types of plans. So they can actually perhaps buy a more cost-effective plan that they can actually afford and say, oh, that's a good deal for me, because it has, as Greg mentioned, a copay instead of a deductible and first dollar benefits and so forth. So you create a plan that is attractive to the young immortals that we need to have actually into the risk pool. Senator Thompson, to answer your question, we will be before you for pieces of legislation, House file or Senate file 32, assuming it passes the Health Policy Committee, is a plan that actually addresses exactly what you're referring to, and it simply uses and applies private individual health insurance to the publicly insured plans. Simply there. Instead of you have an issue, you know, with reimbursements, put them on plans that pay the providers better, that do a more intelligent use of risk management, that is more cost effective in a private fee for service plan, and apply it to those populations.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other thing too is, and I know this is somewhat theoretical, but when we analyze insurance, we're really analyzing math. We're analyzing statistical models of probabilities and likely outcomes, and you have really smart people that sit there and make determinations about long-run cost issues. That really isn't the case for the MCHA. Really, the MCHA is a social program. Not to say it's not a worthy one, but am I correct to say that really isn't an insurance model? That's really not a commerce issue. That's an issue of how many dollars are we willing to pull out of the private markets to subsidize high-risk people that, frankly, would not be served under a market insurance model. Is that a fair statement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, that's a fair statement, and we're using the private sector to administer it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We need to move along. So, gentlemen, thank you very much for your presentation. So it gives us a perspective from the agents and the underwriters out there. And now we're gonna move to the plans. So Catherine Commit is with us today. Thank you. And is going to enlighten us into how what the marketplace is out there for the health plans. So Ms. Commit, I'll turn over to you. You know the routine about introducing yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Commit. I'm the Director of Policy and Government Affairs for the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and there should be a packet in your folder. Let's see if we can get that slideshow. Okay. So in your packet, I'm going to abbreviate my presentation considerably because a lot of what I was going to share with you has already been discussed. So I'll skip over some of the slides, but I'll try to keep the presentation contained to things that are unique about the Minnesota health plans and specific to our market.
And Ms. Commit, if you could, there's a lot of interest in the committee in knowing not just necessarily data points, but where does Minnesota fit within the rest of the country, and also what has the trend been previous years and where we're going. Those sorts of things would be very helpful to the committee.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll do my best. So just so that you can see, these are our members. Many of them are names you're familiar with. Some of them are smaller health plans. Two of the plans, UCARE and Metropolitan Health Plan, serve only people in state public programs. Our members provide coverage to more than 4.3 million people and have spent in 2009 about $17 billion on health care. So about $17 billion flowed through the health plans to pay providers to take care of patients. We employ roughly 16,000 people across the state, And the reason I'm making the presentation to you in this committee is because you have jurisdiction over Minnesota statutes 62A, C, and D, which are some of the insurance statutes. A historical perspective, I think many of you probably know this, but we have an employer-based system. Most countries in the world have a socialized system where coverage is provided as a benefit, a government benefit. The United States followed a different path as a result of wage freezes during World War II. That really led employers to offer health care benefits as a way to compete for employees, and the system just evolved from there. So we have a different system. We have an employer-based system. That's how most people get their health insurance. So the question is, why have insurance? We've already talked about this a little bit. Essentially, you are trying to transfer the risk from yourself to another entity that will pay the cost of your claim. For example, I'll just raise one example. My organization is made up of, we have five people on our staff. That's it. We're not big enough. We don't have enough resources to be able to self-fund. So we, in turn, in exchange for a premium to, in this case, Health Partners, we pay a premium, and they agree to take all of our risk, our health risk, for 1 year. The reason we support everybody having coverage, we want people to be covered, we want everybody in the pool, because people with health insurance are more likely to seek care earlier. They're less likely to delay and get sicker and if they don't have coverage. Let me just add one other point on this slide to give you some perspective. In any given year, just 1% of the population accounts for almost 25% of all healthcare spending in the United States. The sickest 5% of the people account for about 50% of total spending. But in contrast, the healthiest 50% of the population accounts for just 3% of total healthcare spending. So that's kind of a way to demonstrate that it's really important we have a lot of healthy risk in the pool, because Most people are healthy and don't need health insurance, but at some point in our lives, we're all going to need expensive and maybe extensive care. The organizations that I represent are nonprofit health plan organizations, and they really differ from the traditional fee-for-service type of plan that many of you are probably familiar with. It used to be called Major Medical, traditional fee-for-service health insurance, somebody would go to the physician or other provider, the medical provider would bill you, and then you would submit the claim to your insurance company for reimbursement. Here the focus is really on preventive care and keeping people healthy up front and trying to take out the unnecessary costs. We do this through a lot of information technology, and one of the most important things we do as health plans is that we form provider networks. So we identify who are the best providers in the community. We're in exchange for being able to guarantee a certain volume of patients, we want to have those providers in our network, not too many, not too few, and we make sure that they graduated from medical school, if they said they did, that they are licensed, they meet all these different criteria. We credential them so that we can create a network that people will want to participate in and use for their health care. State government has a role in our industry, primarily as a regulator, a purchaser, and a policymaker. Really briefly, health plans are regulated by three different agencies, the Department of Health, the Department of Commerce, and DHS. The Department of Health really oversees quality standards and primarily the HMOs, which are one of the plans that my members can offer. HMOs are regulated under 62D. The Department of Commerce is really the agency that looks at financial solvency. Nobody wants an insurance company or a bank, for that matter, anybody to go out of business or run out of money. So they are always monitoring very closely the financial health of the health plans to make sure that we are adequately reserved, we have enough money to pay the claims so that people can continue to go to the doctor and that providers can continue to provide care. DHS contracts with health plans for the public programs, as I mentioned, and a couple of my plans serve only people on public programs. The government also has a role as a purchaser. You've heard about this a little bit already, the State Employee Health Plan. So CGIP, the plan that state of Minnesota employees and the legislature is covered under. Contracts with a couple of health plans to administer their health benefits for state employees. And then the other thing is the state also purchases contracts with health plans to provide coverage for Medicaid, people on Medicaid, Minnesota Care, and previously the General Assistance Medical Care Program. Policymakers, that's where you guys come into the equation. You're responsible for reviewing and setting policy direction, and I really think one of the biggest challenges you face is how to balance the ever-increasing demand for services against limited health care resources. That is just a huge challenge that we're facing, not only here in Minnesota, but as a nation. I'm going to skip over these because I've kind of talked about them already. Let me go to slide 10. I'll just say about this, and you've heard a little bit about this already, fully insured products, like the product that I'm covered under through my employer, is regulated by the state. The state has jurisdiction to impose taxes, mandates, other types of regulations. That typically affects smaller employers as well as individual products, which differs from the self-insured. And we talked, the gentleman before me talked a little bit about ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, which was initially a pension law, but became more and more of a law through case law, became more of a type of a regulation around health benefits. And I think you understand this concept, but if you have questions, we can talk more about it. Essentially, larger employers seek to self-insure, not only because they can save money without having to pay taxes and follow certain regulations, but it for multi-state employers, it really is much easier for them to follow one set of requirements, their own requirements, rather than having to try to follow the rules in 50 different states. Because insurance is regulated at the state level. Health insurance is regulated at the state level. So here's a picture of that tax issue that we were talking about, and this is just to give you an example of how the taxes apply across different products. So for small employers, self-employed individuals who have insurance under an HMO product, they're going to pay roughly 6.5%. For people who purchase a traditional indemnity product, which my plans also sell, they their health insurance taxes are a little higher at a little over 7%. I'm not going to really talk about Medicare. We really don't deal with Medicare here in Minnesota, but to, I think it was Senator Thompson's question earlier, I believe, Medicare really does establish the overall reimbursement system, or I should say it is the floor from which all of the reimbursement is built off of, but it really sets a standard. Medicaid, as I mentioned earlier, Minnesota provides coverage to people covered under our state medical assistance program, typically moms and kids and seniors. So people who are disabled or people who have disabled and in long-term care facilities, that type of thing, typically aren't necessarily covered by the health plans. They're still covered under a traditional fee-for-service model. And the one thing I would point out here is that we are required to participate. It's not a choice that we have, but we are required to participate, but we are also happy to do so. Okay, going on, just to give you a snapshot, I used to have this in a pie chart format, but that got too difficult to show. But I think this gives you a nice picture of what the world looked like in 1993, where we had the number of Minnesotans covered by a self-funded employer was roughly about 29% of the population. In the fully insured market, it was closer to 40%. And by 2008, those numbers had really flipped. So by 2008, nearly 40% of the population here in Minnesota is covered through self-funded employers. And the number of people covered through fully insured products dropped to 26%. So why that's important for you to understand is that your jurisdiction as lawmakers to have an impact on the health insurance market really is limited in the private commercial market to about 26% of the overall population. population. So when a mandate gets passed or some other change happens, it's really going to affect only those people who are covered under fully insured plans. This is a little more updated information from our Minnesota Department of Health, where we got coverage in 2009. So you can see most people get their coverage through their employer, about 57%. Almost 29% of Minnesotans get their coverage through public programs, 5% of the population through an individual policy, and we are now up to 9.1% of uninsured. Oops, excuse me.
Ms. Kubik, can you tell us what has been the this is the snapshot, but what is the now you told us about the trend from fully insured to self-insured. What has been the trend on the public program side or the uninsured side over the last 15 years?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, due to a number of the reforms that took place in the 1990s to reform how the small group market and individual market was regulated, Minnesota really, our employers here in Minnesota really embraced those changes, and employers here in Minnesota, I think, offer coverage to their employees much more than other states. It's a much higher percentage, in part because there are different protections and there are different regulations that keep the attempt to keep the premium cost more affordable. And I think it was in maybe 1999 or 2000 where we had an uninsured rate of, I want to say, 5.6%. It was one of the lowest in the nation. And that really helped to keep everybody in the pool so the cost could be spread across the entire pool. I think with the, especially with the onset of the recession and those difficulties, what we've seen is the number of uninsured have increased. We have seen that more and more people are seeking coverage through state public programs. So, for example, MinnesotaCare or through a Medicaid type of program. Still, we're very fortunate in the state in that we only have 9%, but that number is still too high, and we need to bring that number down. It's not, at least we're much better than Texas, where I think they have 25% uninsured rate. So there are a number of factors that went into the reason why we are where we are, but I think the last few years have taken their toll on the on people's ability to afford coverage, and also as people lost their jobs, they were sometimes disconnected from their health insurance. In fact, on this slide, actually, the second bullet says.
Sarah Gazelka has a question.
Oh, pardon me.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And it's just sort of along those lines, and I'm just not 100% sure about the self-funded plans. Do they have to do all the mandates that the other plans have to do? I'm just not sure about that, and if you could help me with that, because that is part of what I think is driving the cost of the other plans, and so I don't know about the self-funded plans.
Sure. Mr. Chairman and Senator Gazelka, yes, it's true that when they are organized under ERISA, large employers who self-insure do not have to follow state mandates and those requirements. However, most of the companies here in Minnesota want to do well by their employees, and they really want to offer the very best benefit package they can. So oftentimes when the large self-funded employer might come to the health plan, one of my health plan members, to say, we'd like you to administer our benefit for our employees. What is typically offered in the marketplace today? And we will tell them, well, here are all the list of things that we offer that are required under the state of Minnesota. And for the most part, most employers follow those requirements anyway. Not always, but I would say for the most part, large employers really want to do well by their employees, and so they want to offer the most competitive package possible. But again, if smaller employers who self-fund, that might not be the case, or there may be something there, they're just fundamentally opposed, or they just decided we're not going to provide coverage for thus and such. I just wanted to point out on this slide that here's a statistic. Between 2004 and 2009, more than 82,600 people lost coverage in the small group market. And in 2009, the drop was 42,486 alone. So that's that's, I think, indicative of what's been happening in the marketplace. Let me just keep going through here. So my Minnesota health plans offer a number of different products. You heard some of the discussion earlier about how many different options are available in the individual market. Let me go on here. This talks about what is typically covered. You probably know that.
Senator Vanderveer, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I actually have two questions, if that's okay. First of all, if you've already discussed this, then, because I was late, but cost shifting, the impacts of that, have you gone there yet?
Mr. Chair and Senator Vanderveer, I haven't talked about that, but it was discussed a little bit earlier, but you're right. There is this phenomenon of cost shifting where, for example, in Minnesota, because we are traditionally a high-quality, low-cost state, the average Medicare reimbursement for most providers is very low here in Minnesota, and that's really set at the federal level. And so unlike states such as Florida or New York, their Medicare reimbursement rate is much, much higher than on average than what we have here in Minnesota. So as the cost of care goes up, providers have to make up their costs, and what they end up doing then in contracting with the health plans is they will say, look, I'm only getting paid this much for Medicare and or Medicaid or government programs, and I have this much uncompensated care because I have people who show up who don't have any coverage. So in addition, in order to cover my costs there, I need to charge more for my private commercial coverage. And that is a phenomenon that exists in today's market. And it's gotten exacerbated over the years as we've continued both at the state and federal level to not fully reimburse at the true cost of care. So that has become a problem. And, in fact, when people don't have coverage or they're covered by government programs, some of those additional costs are borne by those of us who are in the private commercial market.
I think, Mr. Chair, just how devastating that could be to the private market is I know my daughter broke her arm once, and I took her in, and I had a individual policy that I had purchased because we were self-employed at the time. And we get to the doctor, and it's $4,000. I said, that's absolutely absurd. And he said, I said, there's no way that can cost $4,000. They just put a cast on her. And he says, it doesn't. It costs about $1,600, but Medicare pays $1,200. You're picking up the rest. You're the only one we can get. So, and it went on that individual plan as opposed to a large insurer who was going to negotiate how much they're going to pay. They're not going to pay that either. So I think that's worth noting. But one other question, if I could. Do you have any records or estimates of actual payments to providers as a percentage of a premium collected through plans?
Well, we calculate what our loss ratio is. So, in other words, why don't I go to that slide right now? I can come back to this. Let me answer your question, Senator Vanderveer, a little bit this way. So, let me tell you how the premium dollar is spent. This is a picture of a pie chart. This is where. So for my Minnesota health plans, in 2009, the amount of premium revenue that we collected was roughly $16.8 billion. This shows where all of that money went. So for example, physician services, inpatient hospital, outpatient, and a variety of other categories that go to pay the cost of care. The one that was discussed a little bit earlier is admin expenses and taxes. That's at the top. That's 9.4%, and that's what it costs for us to process all these claims, to establish these provider networks, to manage or maintain the call centers, to do all of those things, and to pay the taxes, and that ends up being about 9.4%. So said another way, so for every dollar of premium revenue that we collect, about 9 cents is used for admin costs. And the rest is used to pay claims. So the rest goes back out to providers in the form of payment to claims for doctors, other types of providers, as well as hospitals, and that sort of thing. And then this just breaks it down a little bit about how that 9 cents is divvied up. I just want to point out that 27% of that 9 cents goes to pay for taxes and assessments over which we don't have a choice. So, but that gives you a sense of where that is. And somebody asked a question earlier about how does that relate to other states? And I would just remind everybody that here in Minnesota, all my health plans are nonprofit organizations. They are large organizations, but they are nonprofit. And so our admin costs are lower typically than other states where they have for-profit insurers, because we don't have a profit margin, or we're not seeking to pay dividends to stockholders as part of our overall goal of maximizing profits.
Yes, Senator Reinert had a question.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to come back to Senator Vanderveer's first question. You know, when we look back at the fix for general assistance medical care, one of the things I heard, I'm from Duluth, one of the things I heard from my three hospitals was exactly what the senator highlighted, that, you know, this was going, they're going to have to pass the cost on somewhere. So I was surprised when I thought what I heard the insurance agents say was that this, they thought it was going to reduce costs to premium costs, and that's not my understanding. So I'm wondering if you could comment on that. Do you think that the general assistance medical care fix, you know, helped or drove up private holder costs, private policy holder costs?
Mr. Chair and Senator Reinert, I would, I'm going to answer differently than the way the insurance agents answered. The general assistance medical care program for 1 year was roughly, the amount of money that was appropriated for it was in the neighborhood of $385 million. The fix that was eventually developed, I believe, had about $171 million in it. So right there, that shows that there really wasn't the same amount of dollars devoted to this same population. I think that the general assistance medical care program was also something that ran through the health plans. So one of the added value to the state is that the state doesn't have to worry about trying to contract with people up in Perham, Minnesota, or Bagley, or, you know, all over the state. They instead go to the health plans and have the health plan use the health plans networks, so people all across the state can who are on these public programs, or in this case GAMC, apply for GAMC, get on it, and then have access to a wide range of providers. I think what happened with the fix that came about last year was that, in my opinion, it did affect access to care. People were only able to go to certain places to get their coverage, to get their needs met, and I think that probably did have a detrimental effect. I mean, and that's my opinion. I think that it would probably be useful to hear that from other providers who may have seen an uptick in the level of uncompensated care at some of their facilities.
And Senator Brown had, or did you have another question? Okay, Senator Brown had a question, then I want to make sure we move along.
Yep.
We have this group here to talk about MSHA as well, and I want to make sure we have time for her. So, Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have a question on this cost shifting, which is becoming a huge issue. In your opinion, with Minnesota opting into the Medicaid expansion, is that going to add to the problem of cost shifting?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown. I don't really know the answer to that question. What's happening is that the people who are going to be eligible for that program, up to 75% of the federal poverty guidelines, are really the people who had previously been covered under the General Assistance Medical Care Program. And in fact, regardless of what you think about the federal health care reform legislation, by 2014, that figure will, that eligibility category will increase to 133%. So, and at that time, or thereabout, the federal government will start paying 90% of the cost of coverage for those, that population. So right now, the state is going to pay 50% of that cost. And in fact, we did, the previous legislature did account for that state share by making some adjustments in the special session Chapter 1 legislation that passed. My organization's view is we want everybody to be covered. We believe that if everybody is covered, everybody's in the pool, people are more likely to get care when they need it rather than waiting and delaying. Is it appropriate to have the government pay for it than in the private market? What about the cost shifting? I'm really not sure how to answer that because I don't know that we know all of the how that's all going to play out. But I'm sure there will be a lot of interplay with those issues.
Thank you.
You know, that's basically my presentation. I just think that we're really fortunate in Minnesota. We have a low rate of uninsured. We have to do more about that. We still have challenges. And I'm happy to come and talk to you anytime and talk with you individually if you have questions and you have my contact information.
Right. Thank you very much. No other questions?
Brief question.
Oh, yes, Senator Bonner, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Ms. Kmit, recently there's been some articles in the newspaper about publishing the findings regarding quality associated with various doctors and the MMA saying they didn't want that published yet. They wanted doctors to have a chance. And really it was a breakthrough that we were able to have those kind of findings. Can you just update the committee on the status of that?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Actually, yes, you're right. There has been some news in the media lately about one plan that is working to provide that information, believing that it's really important for consumers to understand how much do things cost and am I getting good quality? Because so much of, because we have an employer-based system, most of us are so removed from our health insurance. We don't have to think about it too much. We let the agents think about it. The insurance company thinks about it, but we don't have to think about it too much, or our employee benefits department think about it. But I think that's beginning to change. And, in fact, in some of the state legislation that was passed in 2008, some of the healthcare reform legislation, there was a concerted effort to move the state towards cost and quality information and how to go about collecting that information and making and putting it into a format that would be usable for consumers as well as employers to use. So I think that is the trend of the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we've touched on MCHA quite a bit in our conversations. And so, Ms. Gruber, if you want to come up and tell us about this entity that you run and how it fits into the world of insurance coverage and how it overlaps with our public policy decisions. And you can
Mr.
do
Chairman.
All of that in 15 minutes.
We all want to have lunch, right?
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, thank you, members of the committee, and I see so many new faces, and I'm sure I'm a new face to you, too. So I always stand ready, and my associate, Jennifer Breitinger, stand ready to visit with you and bring you more up to speed. MCHA, Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, it's a mouthful. It's really not real complicated, but there's a lot to it. And so in 15 minutes, we're not going to do a lot of justice to it. And Mr. Chairman knows that. But I think you have a beginning with a partial handout on the slides. And before I leave, remind me to touch upon the federal high-risk pools, which have come about as the first, I think, the first implementation of the Patient Affordable Care Act. But I think our insurance agents, let's see what we got here. I'm gonna try this one more time here. I don't seem to be able to get these to move forward, my technical assistant person, but I can walk you through it. The state legislature did create MCHA in 1976, and only one other state had... What did I miss? Okay, thank you. Sorry. Okay, thanks. The state of Connecticut actually had created a state high-risk pool in 1975. Theirs is very unlike ours. Their pool happens to allow healthy people in, and we can talk about that later. But so I think the state legislature had great vision, and I know it was in cooperation with the private health insurance industry that wanted to do the risk pooling of the individual market this way in one pool, and we'll get to how it's funded and so forth. What I'm going to hit upon in 15 minutes are these pieces, and we're probably not going to do much on premium rate setting and funding. I know you want to know about the assessment, a little bit about the enrollment, and our current challenges. So oftentimes we discuss MCHA by saying what it is not, because a lot of people confuse, because we have the word Minnesota in the front of it, confuse it with Minnesota Care, which we are not. So this particular slide kind of gives you an indication that we're not a state agency. We were set up as a nonprofit Minnesota corporation, and, of course, nonprofit. We are not funded by tax dollars at all, except there has been three occasions when the state legislature has provided us with appropriations. We'll get to that at the tail end. We consider ourselves part of the individual market. We believe that we help strengthen and make vibrant, if you will, the individual market in Minnesota. And I think you know that there's only about 250,000 people that buy individual products, but those people tend to be self-employed, early retirees who aren't quite ready for Medicare, could be students, could be young people, but as we know, a lot of young people are covered by their parents' coverage now. Interestingly enough, the legislature has called upon MCHA to be the answer or the guaranteed issue alternative for HIPAA, for folks that are coming off of group coverage, and there is to be no, if they apply within 63 or 90 days, I can't remember what it is, I think it's 63 days, there is to be seamless, continuous health coverage. And folks can choose MCHA if they want to. My guess is that because our premiums are higher than market, if you're healthy, they're going to go to the individual market. We tend to be a political hot potato because of the size of our losses, and I'll just give you an example. In 2010, we have estimated losses will be about $140 million. And because this needs repetition, I will just tell you that premiums give us about 50% of what we need to run the program, and the other 50% comes from this assessment, or, you know, in small quotes, tax, if you will, on only the insured, fully insured portion of the market, which Catherine Commit and the insurance agents told you is shrinking. I think we'll kind of fly through this. We are considered the safety net. I've told you about that. This is often the insurance for spouses and dependents of employees where the employer doesn't offer any coverage or doesn't offer dependent coverage. Oftentimes, and I'll give you a little tweak on this ERISA piece and the self-insured companies, while it's true that they sometimes cover the state mandates, we do know that many of the self-insured companies limit their annual benefits sometimes to $500,000, very often to $1 million, and we certainly know that they limit their lifetime benefits wherever they want to. And where is the only place that you can come once you've gone out of your annual or lifetime benefits? There's only one place, and that's MCHA. So we do get connected. We do get referrals from the self-insured industry, and it's no secret, and it's a public policy issue that I know you know we need to deal with. Certainly former employees of bankrupt companies, and there's a program, the ADAP program, the program where Ryan White, as you remember, was a young man in Indiana who had AIDS, and after he passed away, the federal government created a grant program, if you will, that allows states to get certain dollars to buy drugs and things for folks that have AIDS. And in this instance, our Department of Human Services is the conduit, if you will, for that program. But we have about 700 folks that are buying MCHA policies because it's the most economic thing to do. So, you know, MCHA is quite a safety net for many, many different instances.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you. I just have one question back on where MSHA dollars come from. Do you know how much of that amount is passed on then to the private pay, what the dollar amount is?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it's a very good question, and we do know. I think you've heard, and I'll repeat this. Our MSHA assessment, the $140 million in 2010, is about 2.5% of the 5-point-something billion of dollars of health premium that is collected in Minnesota. So that entire amount, 2.5, I'm assuming, is getting shifted from the insurers that pay it to the insured folks that buy individual policies and small group policies. All of it gets shifted. Good question. Okay, we'll move quickly as our stomachs are growling here, I'm sure. This is a little bit hit and miss, but I want to tell you that Connecticut and Minnesota were the first pools. And in the 80s, so we were in early, we were in the late 70s, mid-70s. In the 1980s, the pool idea caught on in a lot of states, and to this day we have about 35, we don't have about, we have 35 total state high-risk pools in the country. In 1991, I believe it was, we created a formal professional organization called NASCHIP, that's the easiest way to say it, which is our national group, and it was started in Minnesota, and we're proud of that. Through that organization, we have been able to get a small amount of federal money, and this goes back to President Bush and back to 2002, when we were able to get a small portion of money, which is not assured every year at all, but Minnesota gets approximately $4 million, and we have for the last 5 years, to do two things, to help pay down our losses and to help folks that can't afford our premium pay their premium through a premium subsidy program. And we do have to fight for that every single year, and the only way we could do it is through NASCHIP. So we continue to do that. Basically, we've already said that, you know, we are all about insuring the uninsurable, which is different than the uninsured. Many of the uninsured folks are healthy. Uninsurable folks have pre-existing conditions. Our regulator is the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Commissioner of Commerce has great authority over us, approves the premium rates. Our premium rates in statute can be between 101 and 125% of the average premium sold in the Minnesota's individual market. Blue Cross Blue Shield is the biggest seller of individual policies by far in the state of Minnesota, and so it's a weighted average. Blue Cross's rates are weighted more heavily. In terms of our board, we have an 11-person board. Five of the members of the board are appointed by the Commissioner of Commerce, I'm sure in consultation with the governor. There are kind of assignments. One has to be an insurance agent. One has to be from small business who pays the assessment. One has to be from outstate Minnesota. And two have to be policyholders. So we definitely have a couple policyholders. The other six members of the board are industry, health industry people, and the health industry appoints their own and then passes those names on to the commissioner for approval. Any questions so far? Okay.
Yeah. Ms. Gruber, what we may have to do, there's a lot of information here, but we may have to cut your presentation short. I hate to do that. What we could do is there will be bills coming up that will have an impact on MSHA. We do every year. And maybe what we can do, because I want to be respectful of your time and coming over here, is that maybe what we can do is present the rest of the presentation at one of those times. The important thing that I really wanted to our members to understand is that how you fit in, and, mm-hmm. and you've explained that we have a private insurance market, but yet there is a safety valve for those who can't get coverage in that private market. There's an alternative, and that you represent that And there's we didn't get into, in fact, maybe if you could take a moment, can you summarize what is the maybe the greatest challenge that you're facing in the coming years here, and that we would have an impact on or it can make some public policy decisions about. What do you think, if you could maybe jump to that and leave us with that note for today?
Very good. I appreciate that. Two things. We, through the years, since 1976, our mission has been broadened by the legislature. You know, we're a child of the legislature. And so, as I touched upon the fact that in the early years, you know, we weren't really supporting the Ryan White folks, recipients. Another example of where our mission has been broadened and we're covering more folks has to do with autism, which is a very in-the-news disease, condition, if you will. And the issue with autism treatment is that no one treatment has been proven to be better than another. And it just so happens that there's a very intense one-on-one, 8 hours a day, couple years program called LOVAS therapy or Applied Behavioral Analysis, ABA, that some parents think really is the thing that will really help their child streamline into school and so forth. So I believe it's only Blue Cross Blue Shield in Minnesota and MCHA through basically the hand of the commissioner asking us to cover that. We cover that. So as you can see, our mission has been broadened from pure aid to the individual health market to more of a broader public state of Minnesota mission. And then finally, we've talked about this, and all the speakers have talked about this. We really, our funding mechanism is broken. It's old. It was created in 1976 and hasn't been touched since. And what we're missing is the contribution from the self-insured folks. Interestingly enough, the wise legislature in 76 did have self-insureds as part of our assessment pool. But then ERISA was created and the rules were promulgated, and early on, probably in the early or late 70s, 3M sued us and said, you can't assess us because of ERISA. So we do know, the good news is that we know that our health care access fund and the provider tax, we know through federal district court that that tax does apply to self-insured companies. They do pay it. And so someday, you know, one of your thoughts might be we may come to you and talk to you about perhaps some of MSHA's assessment should be paid out of the healthcare access tax because everybody contributes to that. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for asking. Those are our two challenges, okay. And anytime you say, I'd be happy to come over.
There's no other questions. Appreciate your time, committee members. And we will, at this point then, stand adjourned. Thank you.